Our third case this morning is number 06-3919, Sane against Wood. Mr. Blahakis.
May it please the Court. My name is James Blahakis, and I represent the appellant Raymond Wood. This case is about a denial of qualified immunity. We are arguing essentially that the facts which we do not controvert from the district court and the facts that we accept from plaintiff's own admissions do not demonstrate that he was subjected to an excessive or substantial risk of serious harm. What he complained about in this case was being subjected to occasional bug bites, foul-smelling water, and peeling paint. And he contained those claims in a letter that he wrote to Dr. Wood. We don't know when he wrote the letter, and the record's not clear about that. What plaintiff said is that the letter bore no more detail than what I just told you. We don't dispute the receipt of that letter, but we argue that the letter in and of itself does not demonstrate a serious constitutional violation. The allegations that Mr. Sane complains about are things that can happen in everyday life. Bug bites, a foul smell somebody might have from a dumpster behind their house, even though he's not complaining of mice, that's something that can happen in normal society. These are not circumstances that the Constitution prohibits. He's civilly detained at one point pursuant to the Sexually Violent Persons Act. He's detained at this facility, but the facility is not required to house him in hotel-like conditions. In fact, he's only required to be housed in minimally adequate conditions. He did not suffer from the wanton infliction of pain here. There is no argument that he was placed purposefully in this room to punish him. His argument is simply that these conditions were oppressive to him. However, he suffered no damage. He admits in his deposition, the court agreed, that he received ointment when he was bit on these several occasions. He admitted in his deposition, it's uncontroverted, he suffered no injury from the foul-smelling water. He suffered no injury from the peeling paint.
Counsel, could we backtrack just a little bit and talk first about your client and whether your client is even in the ballpark in terms of qualified immunity? Is he eligible for it? Now, he was the employee, as I understand it, of a private entity that had a contract with the estate. He was a clinical director, took care of the psychiatric needs of the patients, their therapy. How do you square the claim that he can have qualified immunity with the cases of our sister circuits that really seem to draw the line somewhere else?
Your recitation of the facts are correct. We believe that there's clear waiver on this argument by the plaintiff. He did not raise this before the district court. It was only raised upon appeal in the citation to the Richardson case.
Who has the burden of proof to establish your client's eligibility for qualified immunity?
This circuit has never determined that the burden of proof for the eligibility post or pre-Richardson lies on the defendant. Sister circuits, some circuits have held that, but that is the case.
And held what?
That if there's a private entity, an employee of a private entity is attempting to establish an entitlement to qualified immunity, he must set forth in the reasons why he's entitled that because of the nature of his employment.
11th Circuit cases, for instance,
correct.
All that. And so your view is that you really shouldn't have to be concerned with this because the other side simply did not raise this in the district court and therefore give you an ample time to address it. Is that correct?
Yes and no. The waiver argument is clearly there, but I believe also the fact that we were not required by prior Seventh Circuit precedent to raise this argument is supported by the fact that in prior decisions before Richardson, this court has afforded qualified immunity to people in a very similar position to Dr. Wood, somebody who was treating somebody for psychiatric care pursuant to a court order, or somebody who was under psychiatric care in a state facility. And predating Richardson, this court has allowed private employees to have an entitlement to qualified immunity.
Now we have Richardson sitting there.
Yes.
So,
well, the Richardson decision, I believe, even on this record, we can substantiate that there is an entitlement to qualified immunity. This court wants me to explain why I believe that's true. I can go into that, notwithstanding the waiver issue.
I think prudence would indicate you probably ought to cover it. This is your last time at bat with us till we decide the case.
With regard to Richardson, Richardson was clearly a case that was just dealing with a private operation of a prison by a corporate entity. The Seventh Circuit in a subsequent case said Richardson was very specific on its facts. Here, this is a completely different type of facility. It's not akin to a prison. It was created under the by the Illinois legislature in 1998. Prior to this date, nobody could be civilly confined in the manner in which Mr. Sane was civilly confined. The legislature created a new type of confinement. Somebody has a sexual disorder that leads them to potentially cause future acts of sexual acts. Under the Illinois Mental Health Code, which has been around for ages, you cannot be committed based upon your prior underlying crime. Here under the SVP Act, they specifically look at what crime did you do of a sexual nature. That is a triggering point. Individuals who are confined under this act specifically have the ability to take care of themselves in normal society. They held jobs, they had higher education. They were not like the traditional mental health patients the state had that could not normally care for themselves, that were bipolar or schizophrenic.
All the determinations you just mentioned are antecedent, are they not, to when your client comes in contact with these people? He's in charge of therapy once the decisions have made to commit the person.
That is correct, yes. And with regard to the Richardson case, with all due respect to the difficult job that correctional guards have, the job that Dr. Wood has in supervising his clinical staff is extremely difficult given the nature of the underlying disorders these residents have. They're very difficult to treat. They have had, the record is clear in other cases that these types of individuals have multiple crimes that they have committed, and some residents may commit rapes of adult women, they may commit rapes of young children, do different things that are very difficult to treat. A prison operated by a corporation might be a simple thing of keeping these guys in line, making sure you maintain some security, and that's it. You don't have to provide treatment to those types of individuals. Here, the state is contracting out because of the nature of this treatment. It's so difficult to do. The state can't do it themselves. They have to go to an outside agency who's an expert. Liberty Healthcare does not, though, own the facility. That's by the Department of Corrections. It's not operated by Liberty Healthcare. That is the Department of Human Services. And pursuant to the...
Now we're morphing back into the issue of whether he's committed a constitutional violation, are we?
No, Your Honor. I'm actually going to the fact that under Richardson they discussed the control factor that the state may have over that individual. The manner in which treatment is provided is governed by the Sex Offender Management Board guidelines, which are very detailed as to the qualifications that a clinician must have. It even goes to the qualifications of the associate clinical director, the clinical director, the manner in which polygraphs can be used to residents. The Illinois Administrative Code even discusses the manner in which residents can appear before a behavior management committee to deal with rule violations. And it discusses rights that are provided to. That's not rights that are determined by Liberty. That's rights that are determined by the Illinois Administrative Code. So under Richardson, the operation of the facility by Dr. Wood is under the control and direct supervision of the state, so he is essentially an adjunct to the state and is entitled to qualified immunity for those reasons. Additionally, because of the nature of this act, while Liberty Healthcare might have insurance to cover these claims, I don't think that's an important issue because even when a state employee is sued under the State Employee Indemnification Act, he or she doesn't have to worry about a personal judgment against them. The state's going to pay that, but they are still entitled to qualified immunity, do not have to go to trial for these types of cases. Here, if this court did not afford qualified immunity, I believe that there would be a difficulty in having people who would want to be taking this very difficult job on because they would be getting sued for issues that, sort of turning back to more of the merit argument, Dr. Wood's not responsible for the maintenance of this facility. But if he's denied qualified immunity in this instance, additional clinicians will be sued for things that are really outside of their control. In this case, one thing that is significant is that the facility was constantly sprayed for bugs. When Mr. Sane complained to one of his lower-level clinicians, who was a defendant in this case, the court held that it was proper for her to tell him, go tell security staff. Security staff looked into that and sprayed his room. Here, Dr. Wood had a policy. He was not consciously disregarding any risks. He had a policy of sending resident complaints down to lower-level staff to attend to. And I think, in a way, that he's being proactive by doing that somebody of his position can't deal with the day-to-day complaints. There is a proper system of grievances to go through this, and Mr. Sane didn't do that. We don't dispute that he sent the letter to Dr. Wood, but we believe that the letter, as we've set out in our brief, does not establish an excessive or substantial risk of harm and does not demonstrate that Dr. Wood consciously disregarded any risk. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time, unless there's any questions.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear now from Ms. Rubenstein.
Before this court is a case involving an employee who is asserting qualified immunity, a private employee asserting qualified immunity. In reviewing this matter, there are two threshold issues. First, whether this court has jurisdiction for this interlocutory appeal, and second, whether the defendant can assert qualified immunity in the first instance. The answer to both of these questions is no. Under Richardson, a private actor like defendant is not entitled to assert qualified immunity. And under Johnson, interlocutory jurisdiction is unavailable where the defendant appeals the district court's reading of the record. If I may turn to the jurisdictional question first. Interlocutory appeals from the denial of qualified immunity are an exception. The denial of qualified immunity at this stage is only appealable to address an abstract issue of law. This court lacks jurisdiction where, as here, defendant Wood has appealed the district court's reading of the record. Six of defendant Wood's issues presented for review before this court challenged the district court's reading of the factual record. This court should reject defendant Wood's assertion here today made by counsel and in the briefs that he is not challenging the district court's record. Like in McKinney, as this court held, when the record reveals otherwise, that the defendant is challenging the factual record.
What's he challenging?
He's challenging the issues that he spoke about today. What Wood did, whether it was enough, whether there was enough spraying of the pests, whether the roach bites...
Well, I didn't
bites,
hear him say that he was questioning whether enough spraying. I mean, he said he agrees as he has to, or you're correct. If he doesn't agree, then... You're correct. I didn't hear him contesting those matters.
Your Honor, those issues were contested in the briefs. Those issues have been contested, and the district court found that this question of whether or not the conditions in plaintiff's room amounted to a violation should be left for the jury. Did I answer your question, Your Honor?
No, but go ahead and make your argument.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'd be happy to try again. The items that defendant is contesting go to the very heart of the plaintiff's constitutional claims. They are what the conditions of his room were, whether that's enough to make for squalid living conditions, and that's for a jury to be able to determine at this stage.
I don't disagree with your statement of what the law is. Not so sure that the situation is as you describe it with regard to contesting the facts. But go ahead and make your argument.
A qualified immunity appeal doesn't bring any and all grievances before the court. Even where the appellate court perceives an error in the district court's review of the record, appellate courts lack jurisdiction to review that record. And here, defendant's appeal is not properly before this court. Turning to the second threshold issue, defendant Wood is a private actor who is not entitled to assert qualified immunity. The burden is on defendant Wood to prove that he is entitled to qualified immunity at this stage. Under Richardson, there is a presumption against immunity for private actors like defendant.
You argue this in the district court?
No, Your Honor. We did not argue this in the district court.
Why should we put the burden on the doctor at this point to justify his being eligible for qualified immunity when he really never had a chance to speak to that question in the district court?
On appeal, the appellee can raise any grounds in the record for affirmance. The grounds for affirmance are contained in the record here. Defendant Wood is an employee of Liberty Healthcare Corporation, not DHS or the state of Illinois, and Liberty Healthcare Corporation contracts with the state to provide the treatment services at the Joliet Treatment and Detention Facility. Those facts were all contained in the record. The discussion of qualified immunity at the summary judgment stage was very limited. It was a footnote response saying that the district court previously found the assertion of qualified immunity to be baseless, and in between the motion to dismiss phase and the motion for summary judgment phase, nothing had changed to make that assertion any more or any less baseless. Defendant has conceded that Richardson is the standard, and that Richardson held that employees of a private firm managing an institution with limited direct government supervision are not entitled to qualified immunity.
The court went out of its way, did it not, in Richardson, to emphasize the narrowness of its holding?
I'm sorry, I didn't...
It went out of its way to emphasize the narrowness of its holding in Richardson, didn't it?
Yes, it did, Your Honor.
Why do we know how, and they were dealing with what? Prison guards, right?
They were dealing with prison guards in that situation.
We're a different kind of a contractor here, are we not?
Your Honor, it's managing an institution, whether it's a prison or a treatment facility. The case law doesn't seem to distinguish that post-Richardson in the cases from the 9th and the 11th circuits. After Richardson...
You don't think it's more of a fact-bound inquiry? You think that's an appropriate level of generality, that they're managing an institution?
I think that's what the Supreme Court limited its holding to, managing an institution.
That's your reading of Richardson?
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
Thanks.
Defendant has attempted to distinguish Richardson, and these attempts lack both legal and factual support. First, this court has adopted Richardson. And second, defendant has cited to this court cases where pre-Richardson, this court held that qualified immunity would be allowed for private treatment providers. If I may spend a moment discussing these cases, each of these cases, pre-Richardson, is inconsistent now with the holding of Richardson. The cases start with Sherman, which was a case of first impression before this court, and in that case, it was a psychiatric facility acting under court order. Williams relied on Sherman, and Young relied on Williams. Young is also distinguishable in that it involved a private doctor hired by the public guardian on a one-off basis, as opposed to the lengthy administrative task that we have here before us now, and as was the case in Richardson. Wood fails to address that after these three cases, this court has adopted Richardson. And finally, Richardson has been applied by other circuits to treatment providers, such as Dr. Wood, in holding that qualified immunity is not allowed. There's no support in the record for the defendant's attempts to distinguish Richardson. We heard today that operating a prison is easy, and that in the brief, defendant says that operating a prison is straightforward and unremarkable and involves run-of-the-mill prisoners. That's not contained in the record. And there's no support for these statements that operating a prison is straightforward or unremarkable.
Well, it's just a characterization that you might draw just from knowing about prisons. You wouldn't have to rely on somebody putting a fact in the record saying it's straightforward. You keep the prisoner, you keep him alive, feed him. That's the end of that. Don't have to treat him. Don't have to make sure he's getting his psychiatric evaluation or anything along those lines. A treatment facility is entirely different than a prison. That's what we had one for years in Illinois. There was the Illinois Hospital that was criminally insane. It was separate from the penitentiary. One was in Chester, one was not. Look at each other. They were different.
Your Honor, I'm not familiar with the operation of prisons. I don't know if they're straightforward or unremarkable. But in a case that would
say... Well, I think the counsel can presume that the court over the years might have become conversant with what makes a prison function and how it works. We rule on them all the time. So even if you don't know, we might. And he's looking for judicial determination.
Your Honor, perhaps after this argument, defense counsel can explain to me how running a prison is straightforward or unremarkable.
Well, let's say it's more straightforward than running a hospital.
Defendant also says that it's harder to operate a treatment program than a psychiatric facility because of the, quote, notoriously difficult nature of sexually violent persons. There is no support for this statement in the record that operating a treatment facility is more difficult than operating a psychiatric facility. Defendant also says that people at this treatment facility are more dangerous than people at a psychiatric facility. There is no support in the record for that comment. And finally, defendant argued that Liberty is the only private company providing this type of treatment. There's no support in the record for that statement either. And importantly, Richardson didn't require that there be dozens or even one other such company providing these treatments, these treatment services. What Richardson said was that the company is operating potentially in competition with other firms. What Defendant Wood is really asking this court for is a new grounds for qualified immunity, a new public policy consideration under Richardson. And that public policy consideration that they're proposing is, how hard is the job? How dangerous is the job? That's not the standard. The standard under Richardson is whether there's a firmly rooted history of immunity and whether public policy considerations warrant a finding of immunity. Under this test, defendant is not entitled to qualified immunity. Qualified immunity is also inappropriate here, because defendant violated plaintiff's clearly established rights to live in non-squalid conditions. There's a two-part inquiry in the qualified immunity analysis. First, taking the facts in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, was there a violation of a constitutional right? And second, was that right clearly established at the time of the alleged violation? Interestingly, after defendant has argued how different a treatment facility is from a prison in trying to distinguish Richardson, when we get into the question of whether there's been a constitutional violation, defendant would like this court to apply an Eighth Amendment deliberate indifference standard. And that's not the standard for the mental health patients housed at this treatment facility. Plaintiff's constitutional right to non-squalid living conditions arises under the 14th Amendment. Plaintiff Sane is entitled to more considerate treatment than a prisoner. The inadequate ventilation, pest infestations, foul-smelling water, and peeling paint amounted to conditions that violated Sane's 14th Amendment rights. Squalid living conditions have been held constitutionally inadequate for other civilly committed individuals in treatment programs. And defendant Wood disregarded the danger posed to plaintiff Sane, an HIV patient, by these living conditions. Defendant Wood knew of these living conditions. And as the district court noted, a jury could find that Wood's decision to do nothing to help Sane was a departure from accepted professional judgment. The constitutional right to non-squalid living conditions has been clearly established. A reasonable official, such as defendant Wood.
How is this squalid? He gets bitten by bugs?
Sane lived in a housing unit that was built in the 1890s.
Yeah.
It was invested.
I live in a house that was built in 1865.
Notice that Civil War look about him?
It was infested with roaches. He had no screen on his window. He had no air conditioning or other climate control. If he wanted to cool his room in any way, he was forced to open his window and let in additional bugs, bees, wasps, flies, spiders. The water had a foul odor, and he had peeling paint. And these conditions were endured for 6 years. It wasn't one day or one week or one month. It was a six-year tenure of living like that. That's what makes the conditions squalid. Whether the right to these non-squalid living conditions was clearly established is viewed in light of the facts of this specific case. The conditions in Plaintiff Sane's room, which we've just discussed, make for squalid living conditions. Defendant violated plaintiff's constitutional right. He is not entitled to qualified immunity, and his appeal should be dismissed. Does the court have any further questions?
Well, with regard to your standing, I'm looking through your brief, you cite where Wood contends findings are wrong, But as I read it there, this is from the appellant's brief, four legal errors. First, the district court erred in applying negligence standard. Then it was an error to use constructive knowledge. That doesn't sound like challenging the facts, though, does it?
It's challenging the district court's review of the record. The district court did not apply a negligence standard. The district court did not commit, quote, legal errors. What Defendant Wood has done is dressed up the district court's reading of the factual record as a legal error, and saying that it's a legal error does not make it so.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. How much time do you have left? 5 minutes, sir.
Do you accept the facts found by the district judge?
Yes, we do, Your Honor. The issue of the entitlement to qualified immunity is something that I think is very important here. The cases, because this court has accepted Richardson in the Malinowski case under the limited circumstances there, does not mean that this court is then erasing the basis for qualified immunity to the medical and psychiatric providers in the cases that predate Richardson. What I think is important, though, to go back to one of the facts, though. We do not dispute the district court's finding of fact, but plaintiff and the district court never held that plaintiff complained about the lack of ventilation to Dr. Wood. The record does not reflect that the plaintiff complained about a pest infestation. The letter is very simple in what it alleged to have told Dr. Wood. So that is our basis for saying, as a legal conclusion the court made, that was improper by improperly applying the reasonable person standard, by improperly assuming that somebody in a supervisory capacity, respondeat superior, should have known about these conditions. There's no evidence to reflect that Dr. Wood ever saw that room to know that these were the conditions. Additionally, the district court erred in arguing that Dr. Wood had the obligation to show that he was powerless to correct these conditions. There's absolutely nothing in the record to reflect that he had the power to rectify some change. That person would be the facility director who was sued in the complaint. The additional issue that I'd like to discuss with regard to Mr. Sain having HIV, that's a non-issue. There's nothing in the record to reflect that Mr. Sain was being harmed by that. The district court concluded, as plaintiff had to admit, his blood count was like any normal person. These conditions were not harming him. In the bug bite, he admitted he was treated for that, and nothing else happened. The record wasn't developed with regard to whether we were able to assert qualified immunity, and I believe the sections of the code that I provided to do support that.
This is a residential. Is he able to get out of that room? Is it a cell or is it a?
It's a room, and the residents have also a day room that they're allowed to go into. The units that the plaintiff's counsel is referring to, there are two units, A and B, of the old Joliet Treatment and Detention Facility. It's an old building. Use the same rocks that we have down at the water tower here in Chicago. It's an older building. There's newer housing units there, too, that they built. He has access to the day rooms. He has access to the yard. This case, if we were required to protect him from bug bites, would require the facility to make sure we put double or triple screen doors to make sure bugs don't come in from outside. We can't protect against odors. If the water in Joliet smells like a well water, it's something that everybody else in society in that area has to deal with. We all have to deal with bugs, and there's no circumstances to suggest that anybody was deliberately indifferent to him with the amount of spraying. I think this court picked up on a good point, though, that it is difficult to operate a facility of this nature. These people do not have a set time they leave the facility. They must be evaluated pursuant to statute by an outside entity that determines whether they can be released. I think this court may have been referring to the sexually dangerous persons commitment facility, that when somebody has criminal charges, they can be placed there.
Don't quit. Sexually dangerous person or criminal sexual psychopath under the old code.
Correct.
That was abolished. I was on the panel which redrafted the Mental Health Act. I'm relatively familiar with the problem.
Fair enough. And then with this statute, it is a new statute. And I think what Richardson really seized on is that in common law England, there were privately run prisons and publicly run prisons, and that's why there was not an entitlement historically to qualified immunity there. Here, there is nothing in the record to establish that this type of facility is something that wouldn't be entitled to qualified immunity. It is brand new, essentially.
What level of confinement are we talking about with this particular plaintiff?
I don't understand your question.
How free is he able to move around the facility or outside the facility?
That is not part of the record, Your Honor. He can move into the day room.
Don't bother with it. It's not part of the record.
One thing that I think is important, though, is the reporting mechanisms that we have. That this Liberty does not have carte blanche to run this facility. The code is very clear on that. And with regard to the facility, there is evidence in the record to show that there is access to the yard, though, that there is access to day rooms, that the day room was sprayed, his room was sprayed. So he's not simply just confined in his room. That I can answer effectively there. His complaint was that he didn't have a screen and that bugs are coming in. Nothing in the record establishes that he complained to Dr. Wood about the absence of a screen. So that's why we have argued that as a legal conclusion the court drew, which we can do under a qualified immunity standard, that was an erroneous conclusion to determine that he, Dr. Wood, that is, consciously disregarded something. And if I may conclude, we believe for public policy purposes that qualified immunity should not be denied here. It would be expanding the scope of liability to, regardless of whether he's a
private. Counsel, I'll have to ask you to conclude at this time. Your light's on.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
The case will be taken under advisement with our thanks to both counsel.